Layla Rahimi, Marshall Harris, Rahimi and Harris, middays 10 a.m. to 2 on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
The Cubs are going to win the trade deadline in the NL Central. They're everywhere right now, and they're willing to part with Owen Cassie, one of their top power-hitting outfield prospects, as part of the package. And Jed Hoyer and Carter Hawkins literally are everywhere. I mean, as I talk to people in the industry, they're all in, and they're going to do what it takes to win.
That was our next guest. He was on foul territory and now joins us on the Circa Resort and Casino Hotline, CircaLasVegas.com. It is Jim Bowden, the former Major League General Manager. He's an analyst and insider for CBS Sports, The Athletic, MLB Network Radio, SiriusXM. You can find him in a lot of different places, and he's not afraid to share a sports thought. Jim, thank you for joining us on Rahimi and Harris on The Score.
Hey, thanks for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
Jim, we're excited to talk to you about the Cubs. I want to start with some, not revisionist history, I just want to see if things are still the same, because one of the things you published in The Athletic a few weeks ago really caught the eye/ire of Cubs fans when you suggested that they should send Cade Horton, Owen Casey, Kevin Alcantara, and shortstop Ronnie Cruz to the Marlins for Sandy Alcantara. Do you stand by that today, or has Alcantara's ups and downs, mostly downs, affected the way you feel about the haul and what should be the return for the Marlins?
Yeah, that's a huge haul. And of course, I was looking at it from the Marlins perspective and going back in history and looking at what the Washington Nationals got for Juan Soto. Certainly that kind of package doesn't work unless you're convinced that Sandy Alcantara is an ace, unless you think he is a Cy Young Award winner that he was a couple of years ago. And if he's that level, then that is probably the return that's going to take. But it would be really steep for the Cubs to do that. Highly unlikely that that's where they end up. That being said, there's no doubt. I'm working on an article for The Athletic that is going up tomorrow morning where I did an anonymous poll of all the GMs and presidents in baseball. And it was very interesting to me because Owen Cassie, the minor league outfielder at AAA who was in the Yu Darvish deal, is a name that just keeps coming up everywhere in the industry, which makes it clear that the Cubs are everywhere trying to get better and trying to add pitching.
And I actually appreciate you mentioning Owen Casey, Jim, because I feel like it touches on something else. I love to talk about like a second generation of a trade, or, you know, a trade tree where one transaction leads to so many others. I know that's a big part of what you do. And when you consider that the only name that gets brought up from that Yu Darvish trade that happened back in December of 2020 is Casey, who isn't yet online, and this is 2025 now, it makes you really understand how catastrophic a deal like that can be for a team like the Cubs, who want to be flexible now when their window is right now.
Yeah, no question. I mean, that can be catastrophic. At the same time, making a trade of Javier Baez on his free agent year and getting Pete Crow Armstrong, although it took a few years to get here, and now you have a superstar, it's probably worth it, right? And that's what you get with prospects. Prospects are never a slam dunk. They never live up to the hype. In fact, I've always told people, if you really want to do some history on this, go back and look at MLB Pipeline or Baseball America or The Athletic or any website you want, and look at the prospect, top 10 prospects of each organization over the last 20 years. And look how many made it and look how many didn't. And go back in history and look at how many times you didn't want your team to trade a particular prospect or two that ended up absolutely being nothing. And then you probably regret it now that you had that opinion back then. So you got to remember with prospects, yeah, there's some slam dunkers. Yes, there are some that are not high risk. But at the end of the day, most of them are not going to live up to the expectations of the fans.
We're talking with Jim Bowden, national writer for The Athletic, former senior VP and general manager for the Cincinnati Reds and Washington Nationals for over a decade and a half, here on Rahimi and Harris. Back to what you just said, Jim, about the prospects who don't make it. How much, in your experience and in your observation post front office, do you think the level of development matters in trying to assess whether someone's going to pan out, whether you're taking a guy at low or high A versus a guy who is at triple A and is seemingly banging on the door, but maybe doesn't have a spot on a major league roster at his current organization? How much does that make a difference in predicting someone's success?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely makes a difference. And I think today, being able to predict success over the last, I'm going to say 2 to 3 years, is much better than it's ever been. I mean, the analytics and the science behind evaluating players is at the best it's ever been, and it is much different than it was 5 to 6 years ago. That being said, the human element is the most important part, and that is something that is not measured by analytics. It's not measured by science, and it's measured by opinion on the people that are evaluating makeup, character, competitiveness, work ethic, what their life is off the field, all of those intangibles. And that plays such a huge part in the development of a player or the regression of a player. And it's the most important part, and you can't measure it, right? So it's a matter of the homework that each organizations do, and those organizations that do the best at that particular part of developing or predicting success are the ones that usually do the best in the long run. And it's very clear when you look at results, especially over the last 5 to 6 years.
Jim, just going back to the Sandy Alcantara discussion for a second, where do you think his most likely landing spot is?
You know, it's very interesting because you brought up the point earlier in this interview where you talked about him having a down year and how he's been inconsistent, although he has allowed 3 runs or less in 4 of his last 5 starts and has pitched much better over his last 5 starts. You know, that being said, I've kind of looked at it on the outside and I've said to myself, because he's having a down year, why would the Marlins trade him now? Why wouldn't you wait, let him have a strong August and September, and then trade him in the offseason? He's very affordable. You control him for 3 more years. And so to me, it makes a lot of sense to wait until the value's back. That's just my outside opinion. However, when I talked to over 40 executives in the industry over the last week, it's very clear that the industry believes he is the most likely pitcher to be traded at this year's deadline. Mm. So obviously there has to be a lot of GMs and presidents out there that believe what they're watching recently with Alcantara, that believe that he is going to get back that Cy Young form. It's really hard to get a number one starter. We all know what the cost is. All you have to do is go look at the $200 million-plus that the Yankees gave Max Fried or the Arizona Diamondbacks gave Corbin Burns. You know what that cost is. That's not the cost to get Alcantara for the next few years, which makes his trade value extremely high. So if teams, in fact, believe that he's healthy and believe that he's only going to keep getting better, as he has shown in his last few starts, then I guess it makes sense. And so, you know, perhaps I normally guess on what the industry tells me because the GMs and the presidents are the ones making these deals, not those of us on the outside. And it's the GMs and the presidents that have done their homework on his medicals. They've done their homework on how he looks on a nightly basis. So, yeah, I think based on what they're telling me, I'm guessing he will be dealt, and it will be a haul, and it will be one of those moments.
So, as we're talking to Jim Bowden, national writer for The Athletic, front office man for the Cincinnati Reds and Washington Nationals for over 15 years before turning the pen and the opinion to us, the media. I got to ask you, Jim, looking at what's available starting pitching-wise or what you think will be available at the deadline, who are the top 3 or 4 starting pitching targets outside of Alcantara who's gotten so many headlines so far?
Yeah, so what's interesting about this is, as the GMs and presidents are telling me, we don't really know who's selling yet, and we're probably 3 weeks away from knowing that. That being said, it's very clear the Pirates are offering Mitch Keller and Andrew Haney. They're both on the board. Until Zach Eflin just went on the injured list with back discomfort, he was talked about. Most teams are looking at Zach Gallen and Merrill Kelly as 2 guys that are going to get moved once the Diamondbacks realize they need to sell. Right now, they want to buy and only 4 games out. Most GMs think that's going to change over the next 3 weeks. We've also heard the name of Edward Cabrera, Sandy Alcantara's teammate, quite a bit. He's 27 years old. He's controllable through 2028. Although he's arbitration eligible this offseason, which is something, as we all know, the Marlins don't love. He's made 13 starts this year. He's got an ERA under 4. He's got 69 punchouts in 64 innings, and if control and command get better, he's got a higher upside, and so teams may be willing to pay a higher price for him, which puts him on this list and makes sense.
I also want to ask you, Jim, what do you think the Cubs should do?
I think the Cubs should keep adding pitching. Look, I predicted the Cubs in March would win this division. I stand by that. I think, obviously, the injury to Justin Steele was significant. I'm hoping Matthew Boyd can pitch this well the rest of the year. You don't know, though, when the innings start to add up. I would like to see them get another starter. I would like to see them get another reliever, and I believe they're going to do both. And I say that in strong confidence. They have a very strong farm system, and I'm being told by GMs in this industry that they are absolutely everywhere, talking about everybody. So I strongly believe that Jed Hoyer and Carter Hawkins are going for it, and they will make a big move or two between now and July 31st.
We continue our conversation with Jim Bowden, who is the national writer for The Athletic, also the lead MLB analyst and insider for CBS Sports HQ here on Raheemy and Harris. Jim, looking at where the Cubs are right now and looking at the fact that there are so few sellers right now, do you think it's prohibitive for them to put everything on the table? I mean, you talked about the fact that they're going all out to try to win this year with Kyle Tucker in the fold. I don't know how much Kyle Tucker is going to cost, but it seems like the Cubs are at least interested if it doesn't get too excessive what he's asking for.
Well, it's going to get excessive. So if you don't want to do excessive, you're probably not going to get him. I've said this before. I'll stand by it. He's going to get a six in front of his number. He's going to get $600 million. Yeah. I mean, Guerrero got $500 and Tucker's a better player. Great defender, great arm, and they're just few and far between. When you're in your 20s like he is, he's going to age well. You can feel comfortable giving him a 10 or 12 year contract, and he's a complete player. There's nothing he can't do. You guys are witnessing it. I mean, he's an all-star player that hits for average, hits for power, steals bases, great defender, has a great arm. He does the full package. They're really hard to come by. And so, you know, if you're going to look at the price of Soto at 765 and Guerrero at 500, I think it's fair to place him at 600. Now, the question is, who is the team that's going to step up and pay him that? I don't have the answer to that, but I do believe it's going to end up in that area. I don't know if the Cubs will play in that area. Time will tell.
No, I appreciate you saying that, Jim, because I remember you were quoted as saying that before the season even began. And we did wonder if that price had changed just because of what you're seeing in the market and what you're seeing out of teams. So I think even resetting that and saying you still think that's a number is valid information right now at this point.
Well, yeah, and I think it's always about supply and demand, right? I mean, the exceptions are those position players in their 20s that you project that are going to age well and that they get paid. They just do. But the industry changed with Ohtani and Soto and Guerrero. The entire landscape changed. I mean, these players used to be $350 million, which would have been the normal rate, but that's not where we are anymore, and you can't sit there and deny it. This market will be limited. You know, that's the other part of this thing. There won't be a lot of teams playing at that number. There'll only be a handful, two or three teams. But just remember this. It only takes one. It only takes one team to make that kind of offer. And there's a clear fit in the big markets, right? There's a clear fit with the Philadelphia Phillies. Just a perfect fit to replace Nick Castellanos in right field. There's a clear fit with the New York Yankees. After losing out on Soto, they got a chance to get a better player for less money. So, you know, those are two big markets as an example, among others, that probably will be playing on there. So if you just take Yankees, Cubs, Phillies, that's enough for one of them to give them $600 million if that's his market.
And then, Jim, I know we've got to let you go, but really quickly, in honor of it being July 1st, what's the most player-friendly contract where you saw a guy keep getting paid that you've seen?
The player-friendly contract or club-friendly contract?
Player. Like where a guy just kept getting money since it's Bobby Bonilla Day.
Oh, I see what you did on that. Well, Juan Soto is the answer at $765 million. No one else can come close to that. He's the most overpaid player this game has ever seen and probably will be.
Oh, I knew we'd get a hot take in there somewhere.
I don't know that it's that hot.
I like it. I like the concept. Thank you so much, Jim, and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Jim.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it, guys.
Layla Rahimi, Marshall Harris, Rahimi and Harris. Middays 10 a.m. to 2 on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
You know, I would look at how we end the season this past year, 15-5 down the stretch. Obviously, you know, a bitter loss in the play-in game. But the players who played in that game, Giddy, White, Herder, Modest, Luch, you know, those guys all logged big minutes. They're all coming back. They're all going to be with us. That's the plan.
Yeah, you heard Mark Eversley, the general manager of the Bulls. They're all coming back. Notice Nikola Vucevic's name was mentioned there. So
yes, I did notice that.
That is the plan as we talk Bulls here on Raheemy and Harris. Mark Grody in for Layla. And time now for us to go out to the Circa Resort and Casino Hotline, where Nick Friedel joins us, CircaLasVegas.com. He is the Odyssey Sports NBA Insider. Nick Friedel, Insider Calls, brought to you by Hyundai. We put your safety first and everything else second. Learn more at HyundaiUSA.com. Nick, it's like Groundhog Day out here. More of the same from the Bulls. They do not want your picks. They do want your players that you don't need anymore as you push for a title. Is that an accurate statement in your opinion?
Marshall, the front office is a joke.
Well, there you go.
That's the biggest takeaway here after listening to these press conferences the last few days and hearing the ramblings and the spinning. I love my friend John Greenberg's column from The Athletic today because he opened it by pulling back a quote from Karnisovas from a couple months ago saying, he took a little bit of a step forward, and then you've got Eversley a couple days ago saying, we took a little bit of a step back. What end is up at this point? The Bulls are the laughing stock right now around the league, and the hardest part is there are so many good people within the organization. I've known them for a long, long time at this point, and Mike Reinsdorf keeps people in position that shouldn't be there any longer. And I think plenty of people in the organization understand that, but they're not making the call. And from where I sit, this is all on Mike, because we can talk about the ridiculousness of some of these moves and Karnisovas not even being available to speak to the media, which is a complete joke, and then Eversley screwing up reading off essentially cue cards, the messaging that he wanted to get across. It is a total mess. The rest of the league sees that it's a total mess, but Mike decides to keep guys in place that should no longer be there.
You know how I picture it, Nick, to be honest? I picture it as this. The Bulls are like that bodega, the corner store, where you go in there with your buddy, and then you can distract the guy who runs the store and just grab whatever you want and just walk out, and nobody's going to be any the wiser. Because this deal, the latest one, the Lonzo Ball, when you could have gotten a first-round pick for him at the trade deadline last year, but instead decided to re-sign him and now trade him for a player that the Cleveland Cavaliers deemed unnecessary in their push for an NBA championship, smacks of deja vu, because they just did this with Alex Caruso, and everybody said, why didn't you get some compensation? Now, I'm not saying Josh Giddey's not a good player. I'm not saying he can't be helpful on a team, but knowing what they need to turn things around, Giddey's not enough. Isaac Okoro's not going to be enough. There's got to be someone somewhere saying, this is not the way to do this. I do not agree with their methods, and I just don't agree with what they're doing.
You are in a large majority there. People all over the league in the organization, they don't agree with what they're doing. But again, Marshall, this is why it goes back to Mike. This is on Mike Reinsdorf. The mess that has been created is on Mike and Jerry. And that's just the reality of the situation. When you continue to make the type of poor decisions that are being made, when you continue not to get back draft compensation in these deals, and then you try and sell fans on, no. We just need some more patience here. I mean, you got to be kidding me. How much more time do you need till you see that the front office is not suited for the positions that they're in? That is the saddest part. And I had to laugh, guys, the other day. Masai Ujiri is out in Toronto. That means that Masai Ujiri and Bob Myers are just sitting there now. They are waiting for some team to call and offer them a bunch of money and say, come fix the situation. And instead of doing that, Mike and the Bulls sit there and go, no, we're good. we just need to keep things the way that they are. It's a sad state of affairs, but when you see the moves that have unfolded, over the last few years, you understand why they're in the position that they're in. And if you're a Bulls fan at this point, there is absolutely no reason to believe that anything is going to change anytime soon.
So what do you think that Michael Reinsdorf thinks that Arturas Karnišovas and Mark Eversley have done well to deserve getting a second bite at the apple and to apparently be given carte blanche, trust me, trust of this team in doing it in the way that they are doing it? Like, why are they allowed this stubbornness?
Mark, I think the answer is very simple. It all comes back to money. The building's full. People are showing up to the games. How much of that is on the front office? I think you could plug anybody in there at this point, guys. I think we've seen this for years. It doesn't matter who's in the front office. People are going to still show up to see Benny spill popcorn on everyone. And
it's that blatant, huh? It's that easy. Yeah. It's that simple. That I mean, it's logical.
It really is. And the hard part from a distance is, I think the biggest key here is the Karnišovas hire was Mike's big first hire on his own. And when you accept that it was just a bad hire and he has not done the job and you move on, you also have to accept, hey, I swung and I missed. And I don't think Mike is ready to do that yet. I think that's really the biggest problem here, at least in the short term. Because, again, the rest of the league is sitting there going, oh, are you kidding me? Like, again, they make another move and you get no draft picks back again. But this is the way of the world as it pertains to the Bulls in how the rest of the league regards who and what they are. And until major changes are made up top by Mike himself, it's going to continue to be the same way it is. And there's no getting around that.
Odyssey Sports NBA insider Nick Friedell joining us here on Raheem and Harris. Mark Grody in for Layla. You can catch Nick over on the website formerly known as Twitter. That is Nick Friedell, NickFriedell. Insider calls brought to you by Hyundai. Hyundai helps protect you and your family on the road. We put your safety first and everything else second. The Bulls, they have been putting draft compensation second for a long time now. I point to you, Nick, Exhibit A. Joe Dumars, the day after the draft, gets on in a press conference and says he started making calls with the team that had the ninth pick in the draft to trade up so that he could get Derek Queen on his team. He said he was trading, and we found out later, one pick after the Bulls picked, that he traded away an unprotected first-round pick in 2026 belonging to New Orleans. Nick, how can the Bulls not cash in on this and get that valuable of an asset and trade down 10 spots? How does that's malpractice, correct?
Hell yeah, it's malpractice. But Marshall, you already know the answer to this. You've been in Chicago long enough to know when you have people that aren't doing the job correctly, you're going to have people that continue to make mistakes. And this is absolutely what it is. It's really kind of sad because you draft an 18-year-old, and who knows, guys? Who knows as we sit here what Essanguet is going to turn into over time? Maybe he becomes a really good player. We'll see. But an 18-year-old project on a team that so desperately needs draft help and picks and assets, you're telling me you couldn't move down a few more slots and been happy with an unprotected pick next year? It's all reinforcing the point that when you allow people that aren't fit to do the job and have proven they can't do the job well to stay in those positions, you get what you get. And it can't be any clearer to everyone else that the Bulls are a mess, stuck in complete mediocrity. But until Mike looks in the mirror and accepts that, nothing's going to change.
Okay, Nick, here's my big question for you. Nikola Vucevic, my two conditions for this front office proving that they can change, that they can evolve. Josh Giddey doesn't get signed for more than $25 million a year without an offer sheet signed by him somewhere else as a restricted free agent. That's condition number one. Condition number two is Nikola Vucevic is moved for assets and does not walk as a free agent. We've seen that happen before. Andre Drummond, probably the latest example that I can think of off the top of my head. Do you think either of those things can happen for the Bulls, or do you think they're just going to sign Giddey like they did Patrick Williams to outbidding themselves and just let Nikola Vucevic now stay on this team since it doesn't seem like anybody has an appetite for him?
Marshall, what you're asking is, do I think the Bulls front office can make the right move? And the answer is no, I do not. Because
in either case,
recent history shows us that if there are two moves to be made, they will make the move that is the worst of the two over and over and over again. I don't see how anyone could argue differently. As far as Giddey goes, it feels like all along the Bulls made that move a year ago feeling like, all right, we're going to sign him. And I would stress this to any Bulls fan who says, oh, well, Giddey had a really good year and look at what he did in the second half. Okay, you are going to judge Josh Giddey differently, though, on a $30 million a year deal than you did on the deal he just finished. The expectations change. The Bulls know this as well as anybody. Look at Zach LaVine. Everybody's sitting there going, oh, my God, Zach LaVine, he's going to get so much better. He's on this deal. It's really team-friendly. What happened when they signed him for the max? Everybody went, uh-oh. he didn't get that much better, and now you're paying all the way up top for a player who's not a max player in the league. So I expect the worst every time from this front office because that is what they have shown us over and over and over again. I don't even know anymore what you can point to and go, oh, well, we know for sure that this was the right decision. I know all the most loyal of Bulls fans look at Bezelis and they say, oh, my gosh, well, Matas, oh, this is a superstar in the making. Maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
1 year in. Let's take a deep breath here. So the front office is a gigantic problem. But if your anger and frustration is only directed at the front office, you're missing the much bigger point in play.
God, when I'm talking to both of you guys here. I'm trying to think of when the last time, no strings attached, that the Bulls made the right decision, like in a big move. You know what I mean? I mean, you could point to individual success stories like Alex Caruso being here, like pretty good. But last time they really did, even like DeMar DeRozan coming here, which was really good. It wasn't the right type of player with Zach LaVine. I don't know, like when the last time it was the Bulls did something where you're like, yep, they're headed in the right direction.
This goes back all the way, Mr. Grody, to when Garm Pax fired Tibbs, and that move had to happen.
Yeah.
Anybody with revisionist history who is saying, oh, no, they could have kept it. The divorce was happening. On both sides, there was fault. We've all been through this. But the decision to put all their eggs in the basket for Fred Hoiberg was the wrong one. And they knew it. And, guys, this ties back into the front office issues that have been there for a decade. They knew Fred wasn't the guy that first year. They knew in how he handled players and the egos in play. They knew that they had chosen wrong, but they wanted to give him a little more hope, and they wanted to – they had signed him to a five-year deal. They wanted to give him more time to develop. And it just – it didn't happen. And instead of saying, hey, this was not right, we need to go pick somebody else up and start fresh, they waited a little longer than they should have. What happened after Hoiberg? Jim Boylan and that whole experience, which was a total disaster, and everybody knew it again, and pretty immediately, all along, let him stay there. I think Billy is a solid coach, but yeah. Billy with a roster that is devoid of any serious talent is not a miracle worker. So when you have all these missteps and you continue to allow the players to stay in place too long, Pat Williams is the perfect example. Hey, I don't know if this guy's very good. Okay, well, let's give him a $90 million deal. And on the back end of that deal, let's give him a player option. I mean, that's the biggest joke on top of everything else that we've seen lately. So when you continue to make the wrong decisions become even worse over time. And if you are looking for a professional sports organization that is run poorly in regards to how it values the on-court product, I don't think there is any better example of how bad things can be when you take away the money aspect of it than the Chicago Bulls. Oof. But if you're the Chicago Bulls and Mike Reinsdorf, the money aspect is at the forefront of everything they do every day.
Nick Friedel giving us a somber,
that's heavy.
A somber forecast for your Chicago Bulls. Nick, as always, we thank you for dropping by and dropping bombs.
See you guys. Hang in there.
Yeah, that was Odyssey Sports NBA Insider Nick Friedel. Insider Calls brought to you by Hyundai. We put your safety first and everything else second. Learn more at HyundaiUSA.com.
Hey, Nico.
Hey, how's it going? Happy Tuesday.
Happy Tuesday, man. So are you selling out for power? I mean, what's happening? Or is this just, is it the happenstance of the right approach and pitches in a spot you can pull them?
Yeah, just a combination of things. I do feel like it's a product of some things I'm working on and not random, but definitely not like going into at-bats or homers like, you know, this is really the week, you know, this we're going to let it eat this week. It's more so like just clean contact, like we've said. Moving pretty simple, seeing the ball well, and Houston always helps too.
That's cool that you do think it's the product of some things you're working on, because that's not always the case in baseball. Tell us more about that.
No, it's not. And it's not so much like, you know, working on specific things to hit home runs, but obviously you want to hit as many balls hard on a line in the air as you can, and that's kind of what it all comes down to for the most part. So swinging at good pitches and hitting balls hard on a line and elevating some to the pull side when the contact point lets you, and going from there. So yeah, it's amazing when those things line up.
Which one was your favorite of your many prodigious bombs? You realize, by the way, that as of yesterday, over the previous 7 days, you were number one in baseball, tied with three home runs over the course of the week. You were right there with Otani, Riley Green, Spencer Steer,
who
hit them all in one night. Yeah, yeah. It's like you were right there with the very best. So which
just how we drew it up.
Yeah. Yep. which one was your favorite?
I mean the one in Houston on Saturday to give us the lead felt really good, just from a standpoint of had the lead and then they take it, and you know the night before it didn't go great, so to instantly respond and, you know, Bushy have a nice swing to left and then follow it up right away. That felt amazing. And then that entire inning turned into I think it was a 7-run inning and gave us a big lead. And always feels good to be in the middle of really a winning moment like that.
You've been pretty honest with us about how all of this feels, but, and you know, I don't know if you would consider us friends, but we'd like to think so. We wanted to make sure that we were pinpointing that you were doing all of the other stuff that helps the team win, and your team had been winning. When we talked with Craig Counsell last week, he was saying that even if you hit one, like getting off the zero is a big deal. So for you, how much of a relief was it to get off of zero?
Yeah, I mean, it felt great. I think the obviously aware of it, and it's not like the first thing on my mind when I'm getting to the ballpark, but you know, you get halfway through a season, it's kind of, you're aware of it for sure. And no, it's not the main thing that is at the heart of my skill set for helping our team win. But I think I said in a different interview, but it is hard to impact games in the big leagues without really driving the ball. And so you want that to at least be in your back pocket and be a part of your game, whether it's 10 homers a year or 30 or whatever it is. It is a big part of winning games, as you guys know.
Yeah, it is. And it's also like, It kind of adds to the public profile for whatever reason. Like we are on the stump for Nico Hoerner, National League All-Star. You know, like we're hardcore on the stump out here, and a few homers help, right? It probably helps in that regard. You're aware of that.
Yeah, it does. I mean, you want to be an all around player and impact the game in every way, and it's a big part of it.
Yeah. Popeye has his spinach. You, of course, have your Rinaldi's pizza.
That's right.
Right. So Rinaldi's is figuring your efforts over there to make the pizza and eat the pizza has a lot to do with the power. Can you confirm?
Yes. Yes. The slugging percentage since pizza release, it's got to be just through the roof, directly correlated, all the above. So.
I think so. If I remember, Danny Parkins hit a lot more homers after his pizza release as well.
The science.
I don't think that's true.
No, it might not be true. Astros are good, aren't they?
Wait a minute.
I was segueing to real baseball.
No, but there's a whole other thing. That's what I was trying to tell you. There's a whole other thing. You brought up the pizza, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's another thing.
Yeah. Look, Nico, we talked to Sahadev Sharma of The Athletic, who's a delightful guy. You know Sahadev, right?
Of course.
Yeah. So I asked him about your signature pizza, which is now out and available. It's a spicy pepperoni, hot honey, light cheese, made a little crispy, and pineapple. Where are you on the Nico pie?
Well, he had me until the end there. I don't know about that pineapple. And frankly, like, I can't eat all that spice when it's 95 degrees out. I sweat already when I eat spice. 95 degrees out, I'm going to be dripping. That generally sounds good. The pineapple, I'm not a pineapple guy. Maybe say, give me the Nico, no pineapple.
Man, so, I mean, you want to have words with Sahadev when you see him in the clubhouse later on?
I mean, it sounds like kind of like his problem. I don't know.
the hilarious part of it, Nico.
They got other good pizzas there. He'll be okay.
That's right. He can find something that he wants. But what made us laugh is that Sahadev then went into talking about his traditional Indian family where he would eat spicy food all the time, and he's like, I just can't do it anymore.
Mm-hmm. That was kind of the first thing I thought of. I feel like that's the whole thing in India, right? Is you have heat, but you all outside, but you also maintain it with the spice, and it doesn't stop when it gets hot there. So why would it stop here?
Yeah, no, it's true. But I think he gets to define his own culinary intake as an adult. Okay.
We all do.
He gets to reframe that.
We're not force feeding pizza around here. It's okay.
is there something you ate in your childhood in the Bay as instructed by your parents that you no longer eat because you just don't have to anymore?
No, I had a pretty good food relationship growing up. A lot of burritos, a lot of tacos, and that's still a staple. So yeah, feel good about that.
Yeah, because that was the other thing that happened to us on this show last week when we had Craig Council on. He doesn't like tater tots.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's pretty ridiculous. It's a very agreeable food, I feel like. You don't have to seek out tater tots to really enjoy them. It's just a good thing to have around.
Yeah, leave it to your manager to have a controversial relationship with tater tots.
Nico, I was taken aback by that because it's not like he was dead serious about it, too. And then he explained like that my mom fed us tater tots all the time and I hated it.
Deeply rooted thing.
Yes.
I see.
So now you know. So don't offer him tater tots the next time you guys are out on the road.
No go. Stay away.
All right, now I'll ask you about the Astros. They were supposed to be like a third place team, but they're better than that, aren't they? That was probably a pretty fun atmosphere to see Tucker and Presley going back and have you know, a high energy series down there.
Yeah, they did the tribute video really well, kind of tied it together with the two of them and some nice ways, and you could feel just like pretty genuine appreciation and warmth for those guys and all the joy they created there. So cool to see them receive well. They both played well. They're really good at home, especially their home road splits. I noticed are really, really strong. And I'm not sure quite what to put a finger on that, but haven't played there a lot. And it's definitely a good atmosphere. But the Sunday game, especially, they pitched really well. And then obviously hit for power early on. So team that can do some of everything for sure.
You know, Kyle Tucker is a pretty restrained dude. Maybe you've seen more all year long, but I felt like we fans and media got a chance to see a little more, see some humanity and some emotion out of him over the weekend.
Yeah. I mean, we get to see it more on a daily basis in the locker room and stuff. And, but you know, guys choose to express themselves in different ways with media or on the field. And so you kind of get a different glimpse. But yeah, I think you got a glimpse of just like, it's always cool to see guys like videos of when they were just called up to and like basically looking like a kid and clean shaven, and doesn't seem like that long ago, but you realize how much he's done in the big league since then and everything he did there. And it's cool. He got the, acknowledgement that he deserves. Yeah.
Nico Hoerner spending some time with us here on the Speed Going Home show. That ballpark down there has always been quirky, whether it's the flagpole or the hill that they used to have.
Yeah.
Now the quirk is the sunlight for the batter dealing with the sun kind of going through like a church almost with stained glass. Did you experience any of that while you were up to the dish? And did any of your teammates have to deal with that?
Yeah, I think it's a little worse for lefties because the glare kind of comes in from the left side of the field. So when you're in the lefty batter's box, it's kind of more in your face. The biggest thing visual wise for me is if the pitcher and the batter's eye are in the same color light. So for the most part, that was fine there. I think in the summer, anytime you have a 6 o'clock start, like the first hour and a half of games is usually a little iffy, Wrigley included, like. You just get some funky light, but it wasn't too bad. But it's definitely a weird visual on the TV, kind of similar to Milwaukee. Some of those kind of afternoon games when you get the light coming through the windows and weird patterns across the field. It's definitely a little funky.
Did you feel any anxiety around the team after the first two losses in St. Louis? That's a really good bounce back to come out of there with a split after those first two.
Yeah, it feels like a long time ago now, but the. Yeah, I thought that was a real response by the group. You know, no team meeting or rah-rah, whatever, but just kind of a unspoken understanding of just bringing it for those next 2 days, and no different in preparation or effort from guys, but I do feel like everyone just kind of attacked those last 2 days in a really admirable way, and obviously we got amazing pitching. But yeah, that last day game there, you play a four-game series, it's really hot, the day game, it's kind of a easy day to come out flat, and I thought it was cool how everyone just brought it, and we played really well those last 2 days.
Baseball players notoriously don't worry because the season's so long. There's always time to kind of, you know, like get back into it. What is a point when, as a player, as a group, you do maybe go, things are not quite right with us? Because, look, every team is going to go through a bad, you know, losing 12 out of 18 or something like that. But what are the things that you guys look for and go, no, this is bigger than the win-loss record. There's something actually right or wrong with what's going on with us.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to be constantly self-assessing, not necessarily worrying, but like being really comfortable isn't really a great thing, I don't think, as an athlete or a group. And there's a difference between being confident and being comfortable. I don't think this group's ever gotten comfortable, even when we've been at our best. So I think there's always more. And so constantly evaluating, just like our staff and front offices, to make us a better team, but players themselves too, whether it's individually or as a group, I think we're constantly looking for ways to improve. And sometimes that gets heightened in stretches when you're not winning as much, but and that's where it takes good leadership to know when you actually address things that can be addressed or just let it ride out. I think that's the important part of setting standards at the beginning of the year, though, which is what counts as done great. And then it's not something new when you ask people to do this, this, and this, because it's what's been asked from the start of the year. And so oftentimes it's just reminders of core values and things like that that go a long way.
We talked to Craig Counsell last week. It was the day after Pete had just had the moment where he forgot how many outs there were in center field. And Counts said he didn't talk to him that night. He just kind of texted him the next morning, make sure he was okay. Did any of you guys talk to him? Do you need to? Or is that something that he knew what was up?
Yeah, I mean, I think he understood what's happening there. I think it's like if that happens to a player that's, you know, showing up late, isn't taking care of their body, like doesn't do the behind the scenes work, just kind of going through the motions in general, I think it looks a lot worse. And that's when it's like a reflection of other things, but that's not who Pete is. Pete is on top of his stuff every day and wants to win as much as anybody. And so but he is a human being. And yeah, I don't think, definitely not something that needs to be reprimanded or anything.
Matthew Boyd will go for you guys tonight. And since we're handing out all-star nominations, I think that he is worthy. I don't know if he'll be added, but I think that what he's done in the first half of the season is definitely all-star worthy. What's it like playing behind him?
It's fun. I mean, he's a guy who prepares and attacks the game with a lot of purpose. I think we talked about this before, but something really interesting about him is he did his whole elbow rehab on his own. Like, he wasn't affiliated with the team through that process, which is pretty unique. And it takes a lot of discipline, but I think he also created a lot of confidence for himself out of it by doing it all by himself and figuring out his own resources and attacking things on his own, to where he just created this whole system and self-belief through doing that process on his own, that I think he's really had a great career, but entered a really special part of his career coming out of that surgery into the second half last year with Cleveland and now with us. He's in a good, really good place.
Yeah, that's a level of adulthood and self-discipline.
Yeah, right, man.
There. That's impressive stuff. Nico, yeah. I had a friend who took his son to the Nico Horner Youth Baseball Camp yesterday and had a great time over there at Kerrywood Field over at 3400 North Rockwell. How'd it go? How was that yesterday to run the camp?
It was good. The wind was blowing out. Wiffle balls were getting launched. It was good. I didn't have a – last year I got smoked in the face pretty good, so we had a little L screen for me this year, which felt silly. But after the mishap last year, I felt pretty good about it. The kids were swinging it. A lot of good energy. A lot of TikTok phrases I didn't understand, and it was fun.
When it comes to working with kids about this game that's not just your love but your profession – what's the message that you try to get across to them and to the parents that bring them there?
I mean, it is hard because sometimes they'll be like, when did you know like you could be a major leaguer? Or like, it's like, well, I was probably like 3 years younger than you, actually. So if you don't have it figured out, like, maybe get on top of it. No. it's usually like, just that you're never gonna know what baseball is gonna turn into, but just how many cool people I've gotten to meet through baseball and through sports, and whether I stopped playing after high school or not, like, just like the early years of baseball, I felt like were so huge for me, and learning how to like be a part of a group of people and like handle emotions and all that stuff, you know, that sports that we love about sports that I think can be great, and it's not just baseball, but more so things along those lines.
Man, that's an awesome message, though, for a guy who has made the bigs and has succeeded. The fact that what you took away from it is the lessons of it early. So that's beautiful. But that said, yeah, how old were you when you knew, like, I think I can do this? How old were you?
I was probably like 10 or 11.
And you had a hunch. Did you know a position, or were you just like?
I think no, not at all. I think just like once I started traveling around like the country for travel ball stuff and just like saw what else was out there, I kind of just, you know, knew it was a lot of things had to go right, but that it was possible. Just like, these are the other, you know, humans that are trying to do this, so I can do this.
I mean, that's pretty interesting to hear, like, for parents out there, like, that probably gave you confidence in all sorts of ways. Like, oh, I'm good enough to hang with this. I'm probably good enough to do other stuff too.
Yeah. Yeah. I think just like as a kid, just knowing that those things are possible, and it's not, you're not entitled to them at all, but just that it's, that there's that opportunity out there, whether it's, something within school or sports or whatever it is, that, and that working hard towards something can make that possible. I think that's a pretty exciting thing to just kind of have on your mind as a kid, but not have it be an expectation. Like, I was never told that I was supposed to do that, and that's what was cool, I think.
Who was the best youth player that you played against that then made it to the pros? And here's why I bring it up. For me, it was Cliff Floyd.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
When did you guys overlap?
We overlapped in high school. We came through the same little league organization, Jackie Robinson West.
Yeah.
But when Cliff was a senior, I was a sophomore, and I was decent, Nico, decent. And I saw,
remember that one June? That's when your power really came.
Usually June is when it would happen. But I remember seeing Cliff my sophomore year, and this was back when aluminum bats were aluminum bats.
Oh, my God.
And seeing Cliff, and I was like, oh, my God, there's a different level to this.
Yeah, that one-hand finish bat drop was probably crazy with the Easton Magic or whatever you guys were swinging.
Yeah, the old Easton Black Magic, absolutely right. Yeah. And Cliff, I've told Cliff this story because he obviously doesn't remember me because I was a baby when this was happening, and I wasn't really playing. I was just in uniform.
You said 3/8, right?
Our place was the first place in Illinois that had lights. And so Cliff said that when he came to our ballpark, that all he was thinking about was hitting the lights.
Like the natural.
Yeah. And the thing is that he hit a home run that's still going. Yes. So it was terrifying. So who was that player for you?
Yeah, there's kind of a variety of them, but Lucan Baker, who's with the Cardinals, he's been up and down with them. Big power hitter. He was about the same size when he was 12, and he was throwing, you know, close to like mid-80s and hitting the ball 400 feet on 200-foot fields, and it was a joke. So he's a great guy, and we played on Team USA together, actually with Kyle Tucker. But he stood out as a man among boys, definitely.
Wow.
That's outstanding.
I didn't know you're on Team USA with Kyle Tucker. That's crazy.
Yeah, him and Nick Madrigal and a couple other big leaguers, but that was a 15U too at Team USA.
Oh, man. That's fun as hell. Do you know Tucker was going to be good then? Did he have good strike zone management at 15?
That's before I even really thought that walks were important. But same guy as far as the swing and kind of the unique movements in the box and all that. I remember that for sure. That's kind of what I remember most. Pretty lefty swing. And yeah.
All right, Nico, you're the goods, man. Thanks for the time, dude. We'll talk to you next week. Keep it rolling. See you at the ballpark this weekend.
All right, guys. Talk soon.
And now let's welcome the starting lineup for your American League champion, Chicago White Sox. Batting sixth, the center fielder, number 33, Aaron Rowan.
Swing and a drive left center field. Here's Rowan on the run, on the move. He dives and makes the catch for a White Sox winner.
Hang a star on that one, folks.
You can put it on the board. Yes, you can put it on the board. Yeah. Back-to-back homers by Higuchi and Rowan, and the Sox lead it 2-1.
That is short and to the point. One shot out of here.
That ball hit deep. Back to back to back. And it is 3-1 Sox.
You don't see that every day. Randy Johnson giving up 3 straight home runs.
1-0 pitch, swinging a high fly ball. This is hit pretty deep. Left center field, Rowan to the track. He's to the wall, reaches up, catches it, crashes into the wall. And he may have hurt himself. I said it earlier, he has no fear. Rise on his feet. Look at him, a standing ovation.
As well they should, for the way he has played center field in this homestand.
Big go get it.
Tying run at second, 2 out, Palmeiro. Over the head of Jenks. Uribe charges through.
Out, out! A White Sox winner and a world championship! The White Sox have won the World Series, and they're mobbing each other on the field!
Me and Creedy and Rowan were in the hotel bar. For some reason, Creedy or Rowan yells up,
Joe says, play some Journey.
Spiegel and Holmes, afternoons on the Score.
Man, that feels fantastic. When you think about approach to playing center field, I don't know if anyone for the White Sox has had the same approach at playing center field that Aaron Rowan had and is revered because of it. It wasn't just reckless. It was, I'm going to do whatever I have to do to make a play out here. It was doing all the work and being willing to put your body on the line. We are very lucky to have Aaron Rowan joining us here on the Circa Sports Illinois Hotline. Download the Circa app today. Ro, thanks for doing this, man. How are you?
Great, man. My pleasure. How are you guys?
We're well. We're well. Well, when you think about what's getting ready to happen in this celebration of 20 years to a championship, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
My thing, being able, when we did the 10-year anniversary, I think being able to see the guys is probably the biggest thing.
Who are you looking forward to seeing? Who do you know that's coming that you can't wait to see?
Well, I wish I could tell you that I was going to be there, but I'm not even going to be able to make it this year.
Oh, Aaron Rowan. Goodness, that's too bad.
What you got going on? You got some fun going on or what? You coaching? Or?
Well, no, it's I don't know if you remember a year ago when that whole computer thing shut down all the airlines and all the flights got grounded and everything.
Yeah.
Well, I was actually 30 minutes from taking off on a vacation to Curacao, and the flight got canceled. We went back the next day, it got canceled. Went back a third day, got canceled, lost my bags. And then I had to call the Sandals Resort where we had made our reservations, because they usually have a no-refund policy. And they made an exception because of all that, but I had to use it within the year. And so I made reservations a year ago. And if I don't go, I'm out $15K.
That is amazing.
You know what?
That honesty, that's awesome.
We're going to allow for it,
thank
man.
You. Thank you for that.
That is exceptional.
That's $15K, man. That's
the real
deal. Can't
be giving that away.
Yeah. I'm so relieved by where that was going. I thought, like, yeah, and now we just never travel again. You know, now we've gotten completely freaked, because there's some people who are freaked out about traveling.
There's some guys that do that. Like, there's some of his teammates that are driving here or taking the train here because they're uncomfortable on planes. So you never know when all that stuff might come up.
I didn't want to miss it. It's going to kill me not to be there, and I know I'm going to get a ton of texts and stuff from all the guys. But I had no idea what dates and stuff they were going to do anything. And then when I was in Chicago about 3 weeks ago doing a signing, and they announced that they were going to do it while I'm gone, and I'm like, you got to be kidding me, because if I can't cancel again. And so I know that I'm going to get worn out for it, but I just want everybody to know that it's going to kill me not to be there.
Well, you know, it's cool that you're saying that, and people will understand. But it's interesting, because I don't know if maybe this thing kind of came together a little bit late, but I think it came together maybe a lot late. But there was some thought about, like, how many people will come back, because it's not like a lot of you guys have been around with regularity. Like, do you wish you'd been around more or been invited around more, or is it in a good place now? Like, where's your relationship with the team and being around as much as you'd like?
No, I mean, it's not like they invite you out all the time, but I went out there and got invited to do an event when I was out there last month. And I mean, all the guys, I have a great relationship with the organization. I mean, I coached the minor leagues there for 5 years. So even after I got done playing, and you know, Jerry, he's great. A lot of the people that are in the front office are still the same people that were there when I was there. So, I mean, it's a family. It feels like a family-oriented situation every time we go back.
By the way, if you want to hang out with Aaron Rowan, you can. He's going to have a rare autograph signing Saturday, August 9th. Signing starts at 3 p.m., hosted by Windy City Sports Cards, Elite Icons Framing, 93 West 61st Street out in Westmont. When was the moment when you felt like you guys could win it? Was it in the AL Championship Series? When was it for you where you're like, hey, this could be legit and we could end up with rings?
I think game one against Boston at home.
Oh, El Duque getting
I think we ended up. Yeah, we ended up winning, I think, 12-3 and something like that. Anyway, I mean, I think everybody had confidence, but I think that when we came out and swung the bats and pitched the way we did that first game, I think everybody's like, well, yeah, we can do this.
That's awesome. How about during the year? So we were talking about this. One of our producers went and saw you guys on a certain road trip. So he thinks he knows when he started to feel it. But, like, a baseball season's a long thing. Do you remember a moment during the season when you started to believe, oh, man, we're pretty damn good. There might be no ceiling as to what we can do. Maybe we could even win the whole damn thing.
Yeah, I mean, there were different moments around the entire season. One that sticks out was our series in New York. Another one that sticks out is that when thinking back, I just think back to how we started the season. And everybody started believing in what we could do. And, you know, I remember sitting down with Paul one day. We were at the field early, and we were both talking about our pitching staff, and we were like, taking it one day at a time. You say that as a cliche, but it's really true. And that's that every day that we would go to the field, it was like, okay, who do we have on the mound and who are we facing? I like our chances against that guy. This is a good matchup for us. Now we just got to go out and score him some runs. And when we started thinking about it that way, it was like, okay, well, it's seriously one day at a time. Who's throwing for us and who's throwing for them? And we got lucky that none of our starters ended up on the DL or got hurt. And we had the same five guys pretty much all year long.
16-4, you started in the first 20 games, 27-9 in the first 36 games. So yeah, that confidence gets built pretty damn early. But that series in New York, that was the one our guy was talking about. That series where you took 2 out of 3 against the Yankees. Contreras, I think, started for the first time in that series. You're like, oh boy, here we go, Jose. I mean, and you guys, you made multiple great catches in that series, Aaron. You remember throwing your body around Yankee Stadium that series?
Yeah, actually. Some of those stand out in my career. But I don't know. It was just one of those things. The ball got hit in a certain spot, and it happened to be in a spot I could get to.
Ro, I want to go back to what you said about the guys in the rotation for a second. As an elite defender, what did it do for you game planning, knowing how good you guys were when you were putting your starters on the mound?
For me personally, it was, you know, I sat down with all the guys with most of the time, depending on what our pitching plan was going to be against their hitters. And so I'd sit down with Mark or John or Freddie or whatever. They'd just quickly tell me how they were going to try to throw them, and I would be able to position myself in the center and left fielder accordingly, or the center and right fielder, just by where I was moving. And then we, you know, you get a good game plan and you get pitchers on the mound that could hit their spots and execute their pitches, the ball, you have a pretty good idea of what direction the ball is going to go in. So we played better defense together that way.
We got another center fielder on the show later on. Doug Glanville's on the show later on. And like, just the view from where you stand out there in center field, man, that must have felt awesome, especially when you know your pitchers like the way you're talking about. You feel like the whole game is right there in front of you. Absolutely everything's in front of you when you're out there. That's got to be a great feeling.
Yeah, and, you know, playing behind such great pitching with, like I said, guys that can execute pitches, you know their tendencies too, so you kind of have an idea what direction they're going to go once they get ahead of a hitter or you get behind in a hitter, depending on the pitcher. They have their go-tos, and when you play that many innings behind those guys, you kind of have a pretty good idea where they're going.
As you remember it, what's the truth behind Journey?
Well, it was like that quote that you guys played on AJ. It was pretty much the same thing. We had a off day in Boston. In Baltimore, and we went down to the hotel, grill, bar area and whatnot, and the three of us are sitting there having a couple beers, and this lady came in. They started setting up a stage. They were going to have like a lounge singer in there later on, and so they were setting up, and we were kind of wondering what it was going to be. It turned out to be some like French jazz. This lady was singing in French, and it was like jazz. It was a little drummer with just little percussion instrument behind her, and it's exactly like AJ said. Joe was like, play some effing Journey, and it just kind of took off, and then we were all like joking around, we're all saying it, and then from that we all laughed about it. And then that next game in Baltimore, we were in batting practice and they started playing some crap music during BP. And we were behind the cage, and we turned around and yelled up to the booth and screamed it out at them. And then it just took off. Everybody started saying it anytime, anywhere we were, where a bad song during BP would come on. And then one day at home, before we went out on the field, I went and put Don't Stop Believing on in the clubhouse as everybody was walking out. And we ended up going out and killing somebody that day, and then we just did it the rest of the year.
Man, that's awesome. I got to tell you, as a musician who used to, and I guess still occasionally, is setting up at a bar when people are like wanting something else and you're going to do what you're there to do. That is a miserable moment. They knew that they were not delivering what you wanted, I think. And, yep. Didn't they?
Yeah, we don't even speak French.
Why the hell are they trying to play French jazz at you, man? What is that about?
I don't know. When she started singing, the three of us just looked at each other like, what the hell is this?
Oh, God, it's amazing. And still, when that song comes on in this town, there's an explosion of excitement that is not just people who grew up on the song, you know, back then. It's people who grew up on the White Sox too. Like, you are, and now it's got the Sopranos thing going too. I mean, that song has multiple lives, and you got to know when that song comes on, you must feel something.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was the song that we played it pretty much every day after that in the clubhouse, and it pumped us up getting ready to go out to go play.
I don't know if I would have ever thought, being in that clubhouse, that AJ would end up being like the media darling after his career was over. Did you suspect that he would pick up a microphone after he put down a baseball bat?
Well, did you watch him during his career? I mean, the guy always had to be the center of attention. So, I mean, for him to go into TV after the fact does not shock me.
Now, that's funny, because, like, we think of AJ as, like, surly but entertaining, but you, as a teammate, you saw him wanting spotlight, so this fits completely with the AJ you knew.
Oh, yeah. Anytime anything happened on the field, he was always in the middle of it. You knew it was going to be him.
Aaron, I was at an event where he was, and I got him to sign the picture of Michael Barrett punching him in the face. He signed it with a really good sense of humor about it. So, like, he can take a joke, couldn't he? Could he always take a joke?
He's always been like that. He's always been a smart ass, and, I mean, he doesn't care. It's fun. It's all fun for him. So, I mean, he doesn't mind doing that. He's got a great sense of humor, and he has really thick skin. He'll do what he wants to do, and he doesn't care what the backlash is on it.
Hey, as a little kid, were you as, like, the way that Lawrence described you, reckless is too much, right? But fearless, aggressively, confidently fearless in throwing your body around. Was that always you as a kid and playing sports as a kid?
Yeah, playing sports, playing football, basketball, riding dirt bikes. I mean, all sorts of everything I did, it was always like, I mean, I was a hyper kid, so it makes sense.
I was going back and reading. There's a really great book about you guys that the folks at Sabre wrote. And I went back and read the piece written about you. And I had forgotten this. I had forgotten that there were rumors, and I'm pretty sure they were on our radio station, about you being traded back then,
yep,
afterwards. And you were like, there's no way like that's going to happen. What was that like month stretch for you where you go from winning the championship to then having to think about being traded from a world championship team?
Well, let me first just say that when Bruce Levine said that and I heard it on the radio, I started laughing. And I was like, there's no chance. But I actually jinxed myself, because me and Joe went out to Chicago for the World Series DVD unveiling. And we did the movie theater thing and a whole event. And it was the next morning. I was in the back of a cab driving out to O'Hare, and they had ESPN or the score 670 on. And Bruce was on there, and he said, I've heard reports, you know, Aaron Rowan, Jim Thome. And I'm like, yeah, right. And I was literally laughing in the back of the cab. And then I got home, and then a few days later, I got a phone call from Kenny.
Man, you're not upset with Bruce, all right? It's been a lot of years. Bruce is our teammate, man. He's a lovely guy.
Yeah, Bruce is amazing, and he's got the softest hands in baseball.
he can make a catch anywhere in the outfield, probably, right?
Yeah,
anywhere. I mean, everybody loves Bruce. Bruce is one of the best guys out there.
There's no doubt about that. Well, Aaron, this was great, man. We appreciate you. We know that you're busy. You got stuff to do. You got a vacation to plan. All that stuff, man. But we appreciate you picking up the phone. I'm happy that even though you won't be here, that you will be celebrated as part of...
celebrating, too.
That's what I like to hear.
There it is.
That's what I like to hear. Thanks for jumping on with us, man. Have a great rest of your summer. Enjoy that vacation.
All right, guys. Thanks for having me.